Hey, architecture firm owners and emerging leaders. Get ready for unparalleled insight into the development of a world-class architecture firm and a worldwide organization driving the digital transformation of the design and construction industry. With Build Smart, the podcast that's changing how our profession operates. We share the incredible stories behind innovation in the building industry with my friend and co-host, Patrick McLamey, FAIA, former CEO of the international architecture firm, HOK.
You know, Yamasaki's office or firm lasted during his lifetime. And when he passed away, I think that was the end of the Yamasaki office. Helmuth did not want that. He wanted a firm that would live out and grow beyond the founders.
In season one, discover the untold stories behind HOK's meteoric rise from 150 employees in St. Louis to a powerhouse with over 1,900 staff members and 27 offices worldwide.
You know, they weren't as polite as the Kojima people. That was just boom. And anytime you have a creditor, whether it's Kojima or the bank, that wants their money, unless you can raise money someplace else, you are out of business.
Bankrupt.
Bankrupt.
And hold on tight for season two, where Patrick takes us on a new adventure as chairman of Building Smart International, shaping the future of digital transformation in the design, construction, and operation of built assets.
Ian Howell, Ken Harold, and I, Ken was my technical representative from HOK. The three of us took a tour of Europe of 5 cities in 5 days. Very busy time.
Simply follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Smart now and uncover lessons that will transform you and your architecture firm. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Steve Del Orto, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate you having me today.
Steve Del Orto is the founder and CEO of Concentric, a pre-construction platform that is transforming the fractured pre-construction environment by unifying data, people, and processes. As a 26-year construction industry veteran who has lived and breathed the world of delivering pre-construction projects, Steve is uniquely positioned to bring digital transformation to the industry. Steve, I checked out Concentric and see what you're doing there, and I'm super interested in learning how that got started, what you're doing, how you want to take that company and shift the way that buildings are being built. And so I want to dive into that. I want to understand the story of Concentric. And if anybody's looking for it, it's Concentric with no E. So if you're looking for it, it's concentric.com. You can go check out the website while we're having a conversation here. But Steve, I'd love to have that conversation, but I want to know more about you first. I want to understand where you came from, where you started, what your origin story is. When did you discover your passion for what you do today? And maybe who or what inspired you to get started on your path?
Good question. Being involved in the construction industry, especially on the commercial side, literally, I think was just called serendipity. I had always, I'm going back to high school. I had an uncle who was extremely handy. My father was, I would say, moderately handy. If he's listening to this, he's going to laugh.
But, hi, Dad.
You know, building the old soapbox cars and stuff like
that. Oh, cool.
You know, basic carpentry was something that I just immediately rushed to. But in high school, you know, whether it was coaches, lacrosse coach that I worked for that had a millwork company that built fine cabinetry for law firms, whatnot, in the D.C., Washington, D.C. market, you know, gained more and more of an appreciation for, you know, the craft, the coordination that went into things, being both in the shop, building it, as well as installing it.
Yeah,
I got exposed to a little bit of the process, you know, from that perspective as a subcontractor, a grunt working for a subcontractor, and then there's the general contractor coordinating all of this stuff. And then, you know, I was in college, And I took a class through the architecture school, even though I was, well, technically civil engineering, then moved into economics, but still there was something drawing me into construction. So there was this construction management 101 class that I took, and just hearing a little bit more of the formalities behind the process of managing construction projects. And I know I'm boring everybody here, but literally
you're talking to architects. So
okay.
You're not boring anybody.
So the professor said, hey, I work closely with this company that is in town building two of the largest projects in Charlottesville, Virginia. And if anybody's up for a field trip, raise your hand and I'll get it pulled together.
Yeah.
I looked around and nobody was raising their hand. And I just, I don't know. I just didn't want to be the one guy that raised their hand. So I just went up to, his name was Professor Howe, Joe Howe. And I went up to the professor and said, hey, I'd be really interested. So he goes, great. You know, meet me at such and such. So I go and meet him at the one project, and the executive that was running that project just happened to be walking out of the gate, knew Joe Howe, said, hey, professor, how you doing? And he looked at me, introduced himself. He goes, are you here for the internship? I said, well, not exactly. I'm here just for a field trip with Professor Howe, but sure, I'd be interested. Told me to come back the next day, did some kind of interview. I can't even remember if it lasted 15 minutes. And then I was hired as an intern. And this was my junior year in college. So I wound up working and then moving into a full-time position with the company that I wound up working for 26 years. So it was a great story.
The power of raising your hand.
Yeah.
Or not.
It depends selectively when.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I got started and, you know, learned a lot, built a fabulous. My very first project was the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia.
Wow.
The entire expansion of that business, graduate business campus, emulated a lot of the Jeffersonian classic architecture. And Robert Stern was the architect. So learned an incredible amount, you know, just the architecture and all of the, you know, classical, Ionic, all of the, I'm not doing it any justice, but just learning the architectural, say, styles, categories, et cetera,
yeah.
Spending time in R.M. Stern's office in New York City. It was just a fantastic experience for somebody who hadn't even graduated from college yet.
Yeah, that's really amazing that you had that opportunity. And so mostly educational work or all types of commercial work?
No, I mean, just out of coincidence, my first two projects happened to be one for the University of Virginia, the next one for the University of Maryland. But I think it was the project at University of Maryland that actually really helped me appreciate the power of just bringing people together.
Yeah.
Because at that time, this is the early 90s, and in our industry was still very much in that hard bid, design, bid, build, which yielded a lot of litigious projects, a lot of confrontation and contentiousness. It was just kind of the later days of that era. And people started to wake up from that point forward saying, you know, there's got to be a better, easier way to go through life building projects than kind of fighting among everybody over, you know, the last penny. So it was that second job that really opened my eyes to how much better things can be. And if you just extend yourself, most others will extend themselves.
Right.
And, you know, it's just that power of positivity, if you will, bringing people together for, you know, what should be is the focus on the project. And,
yeah.
You know, through that project among many, when you do that, you see that with a project first mentality, and I'm not talking about giving away the farm and being bankrupt over this, but ultimately, if you are working for the interests of the project, everybody's going to come out a winner. And just try to put that into practice as much as I possibly could throughout my career. So,
how did you work your way through that company if you started as an intern and then 26 years you said you were there?
Mm-hmm.
What was the evolution of your responsibility there? And how did that evolution allow you to sort of pursue that idea of bringing people together, where you had more responsibility and more control over making that happen?
Well, evolution, the funny story was, like, back when I was an intern, they made me a full-time employee. And this was in the early 90s when there was a recession. I had friends literally taping dozens of rejection letters.
Yep.
And
that's when I started architecture school.
Yeah.
I still have the 100 rejection letters that I received in the mail that summer.
Exactly. So you know, I get this internship, and then that same executive that hired me approached me one day and he's like, hey, you know, I'd love to convert you to a full-time employee if you're interested. And I said, well, I'm not even hardly into my senior year. That would mean working full-time and going to school full-time with full credit load, but I can handle it. So he did that and then moved up the ladder. And I think we may have had a beer in the future. And I was like, hey, so Jeremy, why did you convert me? And he goes, you're just costing me too much money and overtime as an hourly paid employee. But however I got it, you know, moving up the ladder, it was about, for me and where I've ended up on that project, we were considered kind of in a remote area, remote region from the main headquarters. And so we had to identify and bid, chase and bid our own work to just try to make a go of this, you know, splinter region, if you will. And that gave me immediate, right out of the gate, both project management experience on the project that I was assigned to, but also in the bid room chasing the work. So I got immediate access and experience. And
a great opportunity for a young builder.
But along the way, it was just about practicing my craft, not rushing it. You know, I think these days there's a lot of focus on advancing to the next title, whether or not you're ready. I dealt with that a lot before I, you know, moved over into what I do now. But, you know, back then I just head down and try to master everything I could and absorb everything I could. And it paid off. I moved up and just took on more and more responsibility managing projects. And then, you know, I moved to the West Coast and got involved in these massive projects and then small renovation repositioning projects of, you know, hospitality, you know, hotels and resorts, that kind of thing.
All the same company?
All the same company. I was with the same company the whole time.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I can't even peg when, but it was the early 2000s where I started to transition. And I had a great mentor on the West Coast that was very inclusive, you know, just said, hey, look, I've got this new budding region, you know, looked at me among a couple of others, like, hey, you're the future leadership and be a part of the business planning process, be a part of getting the work, being a part of leading how to set the work up, you know, from a budget perspective and the early phases of pre-con, and then going out and running the work and being responsible for that client relationship. And so we grew and scaled the region pretty rapidly. And a lot of that was, you know, both a learning experience for me, but also a leadership experience for me, really guiding that process. So it yielded great results. I mean, ultimately from the mid-2000s, you know, within, let's see, mid to late 2000s, within 5 years, we had scaled from $600 million a year to hit the $2 billion mark and had expanded from one office to, at that time, two. And then as I was leading the region, expanded and formalized two additional offices. So we grew and sustained to that $2.2 billion mark over about 5 years, increased our margins by over 40%, which is saying something in construction when you're dealing with low single digit margins. You know, if you can move the needle that much, it definitely makes a difference. But a lot of that had to do with the focus that I had. You know, I'm not going to take credit. It's always a team effort.
Yeah, of course.
Just really saying, hey, look, we have got to focus and quite honestly take advantage of the opportunity in the front end of the business. If we set the table better, we're eliminating the risks that, you know, traditionally cause a lot of fee erosion. The owner relationship is going to be better. Their outcome, ROI on that asset is going to be better. And the design team is also going to be better. They're going to have a design at the end of the process that looks like what they envisioned and were so excited about at the beginning without having it be so compromised and whittled down, you know, through some of the negative reactionary processes that people fall, you know, trapped to. So yeah, we really, really honed in on how to better set the table. And we were doing a lot of design build work. So this was done in partnership with our design partners and it yielded great success. And the unfortunate thing in our industry is that it really is an individual level effort. It comes down to the person and their level of experience and creativeness and whatever. Very little of this is supported by a consistent process. And it certainly isn't supported by a tech-enabled consistent process. Right. And that's what we started to slam up against, you know, to scale and have repeatable, scalable success. Just relying on people to do it is just not a recipe for good, positive growth. Things break down. People are overburdened and overworked as it is. And then you pile on additional studies or analytics or stuff that they have to do literally by hand. It's just untenable. But anyway, more on that later.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like that when you moved to the West Coast, you started that type of work. Was there an evolution of delivery, of project delivery, where it was design build originally, and then you started working more in design build? You mentioned that you did a lot of projects in design build. Was that in order to deliver better projects and more profit and better relationships with people? Or what was the reason to move to design build?
Well, besides design build, there were also like the CM at risk. You know, it was more about collaborative deliveries, and those can take
shapes. So there's different types of deliveries, but they were all more focused on collaborating among the team.
Right, because the hard bid is just set up as a race to the bottom. Whoever's going to craft a way to commit to the least amount of scope based on how they read the drawings, and then, you know, then you inevitably, whether on purpose or not, you're just dealing with change orders and claims, and it just gets, it's a hard way to make a buck.
Yeah.
The whole idea of just moving into a more diversified portfolio, and the industry was moving in that direction. You know, I like to think we're a little bit at the forefront of doing it, but, you know, today, I think they're forecasting like by the middle of this decade, which we're fast approaching, about 87% of all projects will be done with some form of collaborative delivery. So that just shows you how hard that pendulum has swung, and it's not showing any signs of swinging back. So people just want to work as a team. They want to, you know, have shared success. Everybody wants to contribute, and it's just a function of how do you enable that and how do you unlock that ability for people to come together and do what they really want to do. But right now there's just a lot of friction and barriers, and it's just challenging. Not to say people aren't doing it, it's just taking way more effort than it should.
Yeah. And you talked about earlier that technology has a lot to do with the solution for that, the struggles, right? You just sort of keep hitting a wall because you don't have the tools that you need in order to do the things that you really see must be done in order to overcome those things, which I'm assuming is what the inspiration for Concentric was. Can you share the story of how you went from that 26-year career to jumping, right? You're the founder of a tech company, right? So now you went through this transition and evolution from construction to tech, obviously in the construction world, but what was the inspiration, and share that story of sort of making that jump from one to the other?
Kind of necessity is the mother of all invention, they say. And I just literally was sitting in too many of these meetings where not having the data, not having a process that was visible and tangible, you know, that everybody else could buy in and have trust in, you know, I could just almost be a fly on the wall, you know, as I sat in with my project teams and their meetings and engagements with their customer, their client, and the design team. And you can just kind of see the challenges of the communication. Nobody was coming to the table with ill will,
right?
But you shouldn't expect people to automatically just trust what anybody else is saying. And the fact that it couldn't be supported with anything that did look like a pretty sound process, the data, you could just see, I put myself in the client's shoes. I put myself in the designer's shoes looking at this going, you know what? There's a big communication gap. And putting myself in my team's shoes, expect them to do more. I mean, it was just too challenging for all the project meetings that they're constantly running to have the time to compile all of this data. And this is just very manual. It's all in a pretty analog state. So, you know, you just have this unfortunate situation, stakeholders around the table doing the very best they can, but incredibly wasteful. And I just said, there is a smarter way. I know what it is. And, you know, my choice was, whatever time I have left in my career, 15, 20 years, am I going to keep running on this broken treadmill? And I just said, no, I can't. So I left. It was a leap, a jump. I never looked back because I had a couple of good people in my network where from the startup and technology side, not having to do with my industry, I just said, Steve, look, building a technology company is not any different than the company you've been building. You don't know how to do the structural engineering for the Salesforce Tower or the Golden State Warriors Arena or any of the projects you've built, but you knew how to build a team and you knew how to set the vision and you kind of worked the whole plan to its end result. And you can do that in software just like you can do with a building. And they were right. I mean, once I jumped in and got a feel for it, you know, it's not easy. And I don't think anybody can just do it, but at the same time, it's doable. And it was a far easier, say, translation or transition yeah. that I had to make from that business to this business. But, you know, the great thing, and I think it is a strength of our company, is just that deep domain expertise, which makes all the difference in the world with technology. Is, you know, anybody can build software to solve somebody's problems. It takes a lot of time to learn about the other person's problems and the business case and even the business that you're in. If you're from outside of that given industry, I don't know how people do it, but from within, living and breathing these workflows and processes, and not just from my contractor perspective, but from the designer perspective and the owner perspective, which I spent a decent enough time with them to have an appreciation for.
Yeah.
Building something that balances all three of their needs and the perspectives with that project first focus has been very rewarding. You know, it's really interesting to be able to take all of these ideas and through our team, bring them to life, see them work. You know, not everything you dream up in your head actually
right.
work,
yeah.
but to actually see it work. And then the validation from the market saying, you know, there are a couple options out there. They do one thing, you know, whatever. But when they see what we're doing, not only what we have today and how fast we've built it, but to appreciate the roadmap and the vision going forward, and to see how excited they are, there's no more rewarding feeling. It's pretty fantastic.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Accurate data is crucial, especially in today's business environment. Outdated and inaccurate data leads to turnarounds, delays, and rising costs. With supply chain and staffing issues, these costs and delays can multiply. That's why a resource like RCAT.com is so important. RCAT works with manufacturers to keep their data up to date and accurate, and offers it to you easily, accessible, and free. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find what you need fast and download it right there on their site without needing to pay for anything. It's free. You don't even have to register. So go try RCAT.com today. That's ARCAT.com. Unlock your full potential as an architect business owner at Entre Architect Network. Since 2013, Entre Architect has been the premier membership community designed exclusively for small firm entrepreneur architects like you. Join a vibrant community of like-minded professionals and gain access to a wealth of resources, mentorship, and support. From comprehensive courses to expert guidance, Entre Architect Network equips you with the necessary tools to thrive in your career. Master business strategies, enhance your marketing techniques, and excel in project management, all while fulfilling your continuing education requirements along the way. Break free from the isolation and connect with a supportive network that understands the unique challenges that you face as an architect business owner. Whether you're a startup architect or a seasoned professional looking to make a difference, join us and we will help you elevate your career, boost your confidence, and unlock opportunities for your architecture firm. When our community of entrepreneur architects is linked and leveraged as one, there's no limit to the impact that we can have on the world. Visit EntreArchitect.com today and become part of our thriving network. Unleash the full potential of your architecture business. Join Entre Architect Network today, the premier global business organization for small firm architects. Learn more at EntreArchitect.com. Did you have the idea for Concentric before you left, or did you leave knowing that this problem needs to be solved? I'm gotten to a point in my career in construction that I'm going to take what I've learned. I'm going to go build this idea that I have I don't know what it is. Where did the idea for Concentric come from? Or where in the timeline did the idea for Concentric come from?
Now, there was the need and the frustration that was the motivation.
Just want to solve the problem.
Solution had not crystallized. I left.
Yeah.
You know, and then we had COVID around the time that I left too. So, you know, with all the shutdowns and all of the disruption to our entire lives, I had time to research and prototype and talk to people and validate. So, you know, took full advantage of that time frame. So that way
we
kind of emerged from the pandemic, at least what we were dealing with at the time, and business came back. You know, I had a lot of knocks on the door. Hey, you know, I know you were talking about Concentric.
Yeah.
We're needing to do things differently. We've learned our lesson. You know, we had small contractors that were still using on-premise software. They hadn't done anything to move into the cloud. And so that was a massive shock for them. You had just the virtual interactions. I mean, think about, you know, full well, you're in a room, you can pin up all of the drawings, you can have a very productive in-person charrette and really get a lot of stuff done. Trying to do that virtually through Zoom may not be better or worse, I don't know, but it's definitely different and it's not as productive, I found, from just that ideation and all of the stuff that occurs when you're together. So something needed to be done to at least make that more productive. And so, you know, got a lot of knocks on the door, which told me it was time. And we've been steady at it since.
Yeah. So good timing, a good location, right? You're in San Francisco.
Yep.
Probably no better place in the world to start a tech company. And so you jump with support from friends saying, hey, this can happen. You can do this. Let's go do this. I love that part of the story that you just jumped and said, okay, we're going to just go do this, figure it out. So tell me, what does Concentric do? Like from an architect's point of view, somebody on the design team, what does it do and how does it help the construction process?
Yeah. So again, as the first holistic platform, which is critical because forget about the term pre-construction, which I think people associate with the contractor. I mean, this is just literally the design phase from just the idea to when all of that, you know, design, permitting, budget, procurement work is done and you have subs and you're swinging steel and pouring concrete, that whole period, there's a vast array of workflows. And some of it you whip up an ad hoc spreadsheet, you know, from a designer's perspective. I've seen the massive shift and transition into just the 3D design, Revit and all of those, Bentley and those products. But a lot of the business side, you know, the design side is served by those great, you know, design tools. But how you manage process and how you manage the business from a designer's perspective, from the developer owner's perspective, and even from the contractor's perspective is just a big, big void, big white space filled only with ad hoc spreadsheets and an occasional point solution here or there.
Yep.
So what it does is a first base trying to unite everybody. You know, if we can have a platform that as more and more stuff is built on the platform, bringing people into one place that they can do all of that work. It may not be with Concentric built tools, but, you know, other tools that we interface with. But, you know, it's kind of crazy to have all of this data that the cost of the project, whether it's the hard costs or other elements, you coming up with what you think it is and the GC has what they think it is and the owner has their version of what they think it is. You know, it exists. And if you want the most reliable data, it would be the data that you're going to go to risk and go ultimately build. So, you know, why not draw from that instead of making up your own stuff? You know, it's kind of a bad example, but bringing everybody in.
Yeah. So you have a single source and you use the word truth on the website, a single source of truth that everybody is in agreement that what's on Concentric is the data. That's what we're all working on. The designers agree. The owners agree, the contractors agree, the subcontractors agree, everybody who is involved on the project from the point of the project starting, right, where the client starts hiring a team all the way to the point where you start breaking ground, right? That's the period of the process. So architects massively involved in that and contractors and in a collaborative process, the contractors involved in that process as well, going back and forth on costs and materials and methods and how this is going to be done. A tool like this, where everybody's looking at the same thing, those efficiencies happen very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
As compared to, okay, who's got the drawings? Is that the most recent set of paper drawings?
Exactly.
Nope, those are in my truck. Let me go down and get the...
I would walk the proverbial shop floor in the office back in the day and just observe what our estimators were up against in order to just do their given pre-construction work. And a lot of their time was spent chasing down, hey, I've got to price something. I don't think I have the most current version of this. And they're emailing, calling, texting, whatever. The architect trying to get that, you know, the owner's calling, you know, our team for, hey, it's 5 o'clock on Friday. I need the most current estimate because I've got a big meeting with my lender I have to prepare for over the weekend. And everybody's like chasing information. And when you add it all up, I mean, I've had people tell me that they think their people are working as little as 30% over capacity to as high as 70% over capacity. And so that's nuts at a time where we don't have enough people to meet the demand of all the things that are being built. And so the last thing you can afford is having your person take twice as long to do something than it should take. And arguably with technology, you know, it's even a bigger double swing than that in terms of going from 2x to maybe 0.5x and getting a lot more bandwidth out of your team. This isn't about replacing people with technology. This is about augmenting them so that people can focus on what they need to focus on and what they do well as a human, and even have a better work-life balance so that they can actually not have to work, you know, 15, 16-hour days to get something done.
It's an Iron Man suit.
Yeah. But I mean, right? Back to your point, what we see, we've been building the platform now for 7 months. So we've built an incredible amount in a very short period of time. And we're already having conversations with, I just had one last week with a big global named architect, and, you know, was talking with their technical steering committee, and they were super interested and fascinated with the idea that they could jump into a platform, have a conversation as a team with the builder, the developer, and have prior project data brought forward, normalized, and showcased as, hey, this is a reliable target point for us to focus how to drive the facade costs or how to drive a mechanical cost by the proper selection of systems before we even put, you know, lines on paper. Because that's the unfortunate thing. Everybody just throws random round numbers at things, typically probably a little high. And then you got to work really hard to constantly wind and unwind what you're drawing and in a reactive state to get there. Incredibly inefficient, incredibly financially taxing for firms. And, you know, what's the upside? You have a grand vision that gets whittled down into something less. It's a horrible process that everybody has to endure. And, you know, I always felt, you know, a lot of empathy for the design team, because as a design builder, we had a little bit more control of the overall project and engagement. But without process, you know, we were doing moderately better than the traditional way, but because there was just a little bit more sharing, but it just wasn't very convenient. And, you know, I think all the stakeholders don't quite appreciate the needs and the way things are consumed by the other. You know, an estimator rattling off a lot of facts and figures and whatnot out of the estimate, you know, arguably just doesn't resonate with a designer. But what we would do selectively, because it took a lot of effort, our people would do a great thorough job using like on-screen takeoff. And they would literally, in a very organized way, color code the assumptions they were making without having design information on finishes and, you know, this is what I'm assuming here, this is what I'm assuming there. And then when we would print these colored PDFs and make a binder and then hand it to the design team and say, hey, look, at least be guided by this, huge amount of effort. Just transmitting that thing and keeping it up to date is an additional effort. But it made a big impact for the designer to really understand, okay, you know, I've got whatever dowel, you know, tile level 2 that I can place in these bathrooms based on what I'm seeing here. And so they were able to more effectively truly design to a given dollar figure, but most people, if you're getting it at all, they're just shoving the estimate to you, which is not organized in a way that I think design teams can do anything with. And so you just got these fundamental miscommunications or lack of understanding. But I think a platform with what we're developing and what I was talking to the steering committee about was, you know, how do we take and enable a lot of the sharing of that information while protecting everybody's sensitive pieces of that information? But 80, 90% of the project information, you know, isn't sensitive or proprietary within the team. Why shouldn't people be able to rely on it, have access to it, enhance it, and not have to create their own version of what they think the truth is to get their job done? So I'm excited for, as we continue to grow and expand, to be, you know, also building what the design community would want and need to address the business and process side of what you do, not touching the design and, you know,
yeah,
three-dimensional design, but, you know, just things like tracking design ideas and issues. You know, people are creating design issue logs. They're creating quality control. You know, okay, does this meet the definition of 100% DD set? And typically we would find the architect who's stamping the set of drawings wants to make sure that they're, you know, yep, that's included. This complies to code, blah, blah, blah. But without a system, that is a manual process that might not be consistently or conveniently followed by the team each and every time. And I think that can be greatly solved and enhanced and maybe in some ways automated.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Certainly automated a lot of it in the future, if not current.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the market that you've chosen, pre-construction, was that a strategic decision or was that just, you know, that was the idea? You know, let's focus on pre-construction and that's it. What does the next couple of years look like for Concentric?
You know, if you do look at the landscape of the technology that exists, and if you break down the life cycle of a project, you have three, arguably four, you know, segments of its life. You've got just the early phase that is prior to any architect or designer getting involved. It's just the idea, it's the pre-construction. But, you know, that even involves just advertising and going through some kind of a selection process before anybody's doing any pre-construction work, whether it's the architect or the builder. But then you do have that design phase, that pre-construction phase, and then you have the actual construction phase. And then I like to remind people not to forget about the, call it the last phase, which is the operation and maintenance of the asset.
Post-construction.
And, you know, there's a lot of focus on the construction phase, be it project management platforms, or there's no shortage of of apps and stuff to do things that, you know, safety and all of that. But what you don't see at all is much of anything in this pre-construction space. You know, there's always advancements with Revit, three-dimensional design, and we've seen a couple point solutions pop up to address how you bid to the subcontractor market, as an example.
Yeah.
And we have some very good, reliable estimating calculator software, but, you know, that's just one of these ecosystems in the vast array of ecosystems, and the rest of it is white space. And it was always the area I was most passionate about anyway, even though I was a project manager and running, you know, construction phase projects. But I knew that the greatest impact you can have, and it's not to one company's profitability, but the greatest impact you can have that even shapes whether a project is a go or a no-go altogether, you know, is at the front end of the process. And so nothing there. It's a passion. It's just the logical place that Concentric is hyper-focused in just building that out, because it's so underserved. There's so much that does need to be addressed that, you know, we'll have a full plate for a while. But we also see incredible, I mean, that's a little bit of the spirit of the name Concentric, in that what we do as a platform with just benefiting the project. Just think about the concentric rings on a 360-degree basis. The benefit or the power is shared and amplified by, you know, even secondary or tertiary stakeholders. But, you know, ultimately, with more data, with more structured process, yields higher degree of confidence, higher degree of accuracy in, you know, taking a given risk for that amount of money, whatever the case may be. I have full conviction that we will drastically reduce the perceived cost of a project by the elimination of just all those belt, you know, suspenders and tight-fitting pants of contingencies on top of contingencies, to where, you know, the cost of these projects are, I don't want to say artificially inflated, but, you know, it's fear money. It's the fear
exactly
creeps into the pro forma. And if we can get rid of a lot of that, there will always be needs for contingencies. But if it can be drastically reduced without anybody taking additional risk, think about how many housing projects, how many educational facilities, how many healthcare facilities could be built that today in the status quo are deemed, you know, non-viable because it's just beyond the tipping point on the pro forma. It's as simple as that, you know.
Yeah.
It's the tipping point on the pro forma. And if we can get everything below that tipping point, we can build out a heck of a lot more. So,
yeah, I love living in the time that we're living. I've started architecture before computers were really a primary tool for architecture. My first job was on a drafting board. I was the first one in my studio to start using CAD. And then we watched BIM happen. And now we're seeing new technology solutions shifting the way our built environment is constructed. And it's just going to get more efficient and more effective and just make the world better.
Yeah.
It's exciting to have lived through that process of where we are today and to see where we're going in the future. It's such an exciting time. And to hear a story like yours, a student who gets this internship because you raised your hand and the journey that you went through for 26 years, you know, building some of the biggest buildings on the West Coast, to starting a tech company, right? I'm sure when you got that first job, starting a tech company was not on the list of possibilities.
No, we didn't even have email when I was first starting my first job, I think. So to be involved in technology to this degree is kind of mind-blowing.
It's such a great story, motivational, inspirational. I appreciate you coming by here and sharing the story. Before we go, I would love to get your take on the question that I ask all my guests. You've essentially built one company, you know, the construction company when you launched the West Coast division of it. So you've built it from scratch to multi-billion dollar company. Now you're starting a new company. What would you say to the listeners who are primarily small firms? What can they do today, right now, to build a better business for tomorrow?
That is a good question. I think I would fall back on what is always my tried and true magic equation, which is, you know, talent plus technology is going to help you achieve success. So on that, two things there. One, you know, always be bullish on talent. You know, if you find somebody, even though it might not be the best timing budget wise, or you may not even have something immediately for them to go to work on, if you see somebody that has the kind of the hunger and the fire in the belly and the talent and motivation, you scoop them up, because I think they're going to open doors and create opportunities. And, you know, if you can string a few of those folks together and create a team, it's going to take you way past anything you think you can do on your own. But secondly, I think to your point that you made a minute ago, it's these are exciting times. And I think, you know, the workforce that is coming on, either this younger generation or the current generation that's really taking the reins of a lot of these organizations, are coming from more of that tech generation. And so there's an expectation that, you know, you're not going to do it the old fashioned way. And you may not even do it the same way for too long, because it's expected to be changed, disrupted, whatever. But I think don't shy away from it. Don't say, well, you know, that's the flavor of the month, or we've got to do it this way because it's the proven way. I think having a more open mind and embracing new ways of doing things. And I think you're talented team will have a strong voice and opinion on. So people of like our generation need to kind of get out of their way, right?
Yeah.
And just let them, give them the vision, give them the leadership, be there to support. But in many cases, just set them up for success and get out of their way. and just be almost like guardrails on the highway, just making sure they don't make an extreme left and drive off a cliff. But if they can kind of stay on the straight and narrow, even if they bounce around a little bit, you're still moving pretty fast and going far.
Great advice. Talent plus technology equals success. I love it. That's a great answer. His name is Steve Del Orto. The company is Concentric. Just leave off the E in centric. So it's concntric.com is the company. It's concentric.com is the website. Go check them out. Super interesting things they're doing over there at Concentric. Steve, I appreciate you for doing what you're doing, for being on the job and building some of these buildings that the world lives and plays and works in, and then taking a leap, jumping, having an idea, seeing an opportunity to make the world better through technology. I appreciate you for doing that. And I appreciate you for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Well, thanks, Mark. This has been an honor and a pleasure. And, you know, it also kind of turned that around and, you know, your audience, this whole thing takes a community. And like I said, it's about the project. And if we solve it for the project, all the stakeholders win. So I invite and encourage the design community and the following of the podcast here to be a part of this. So reach out and do check us out. But, you know, definitely we'd love to be able to rely on you for feedback and input and be a part of our development. So appreciate the opportunity, Mark.
Yeah, you're welcome. Is there a place, a specific place you'd like them to go to connect with you? Or should they just go to the website? Is there a good way to connect with you directly, email, or is there a contact form?
Oh, yeah. If they want to reach out to me directly, it's steve@concentric.com. But if they want to just check out the website and even book a demo, they can do that through our website too. But whatever's easiest. But
we'll all right.
Talk to you.
We'll have links to all of that stuff and your email on the show notes.
Awesome.
Thanks for coming by. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Mark.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a 5-star rating, write a quick review, and share a link to this episode with a friend, because that is how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. By sharing a rating, write a review, share a link to this episode with a friend. I appreciate you for that. Thank you to all our sponsors for this episode, RCAT and Entree Architect Network. Links to sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode and every episode, found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network, the next evolution of interactive media and resources for the AEC community and beyond. You can now earn continuing education credits for listening to this podcast. Select episodes of Entree Architect Podcast are approved for AIA continuing education credit. Learn more about our new Gable Members program at gablemedia.com/members. That's gablemedia.com/members. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage. Love, learn, and go share what you know.
I've mentioned it to my family, but in terms of telling people like, oh yeah, we're doing this, I'm looking for projects, you got anything? I'm not there yet because it scares the shit out of me.
Dreaming of launching your own architecture firm? Well, buckle up for a wild ride with Emerging, the podcast that shares what it's really like to start an architecture firm.
Where do we begin? We don't even know what type of business to formalize as. Is it an LLC? Is it an LLP? Like, how are taxes? I mean, the list is astronomical.
Season 1 featured founders Jeffrey, Lexi, and Chris, owners of Level Studio Architecture, are your fearless guides on this unfiltered journey from napkin sketches to a thriving studio.
One evening, stumbled into one last dive, we sat at the bar and pondered our postgraduate futures. Amidst the conversation, a napkin became the canvas for our aspirations, sketching plans and milestones, sealing our heartfelt commitment and shared dreams.
In drawing down dreams on a napkin collectively, then, you know, in your head, you've rooted like, oh, I'm connected to these people, like, long term.
The process of starting an architecture practice brims with excitement and challenges. demanding meticulous planning, flawless execution, and unyielding resilience.
I kind of hate the term because it's so overly used, but I think everybody knows imposter syndrome. And I think it's so real to this day. I don't know if it's with everybody, but with me, I'm always questioning, like, us, can we do this? Are we ready to do this? Are we prepared? Can we do it?
Did we just decide a name?
We did it, guys.
Oh my
one
God.
That came out of nowhere.
It came out of nowhere. I liked it. I saw it.
Ready to turn your aspirations into reality? Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Emerging and chart your own path to architectural success.
Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say, like, that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.